This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, I'm Mark Darcy, one of the BBC's parliamentary correspondents. On Friday the 8th of September, the Lords discussed the plight of people kept in slavery in 21st century Britain.
Women who've been raped 10 times a day and asked for drugs to save them from the pain.
The government stands accused of stacking key committees with Tory MPs.
I think it is an affront to democracy. It is a constitutional outrage.
And one MP's efforts to stop knives blighting the lives of young people.
Actually, there are good things out there that they can do that don't involve crime and don't involve carrying knives.
But first tonight, in the Lords today, Piers heard some harrowing descriptions of people being kept in slavery in modern Britain.
She was trafficked. She was raped severely, brutally attacked. She went to the police, who listened to her accounts, but didn't believe her rape had happened. And so she signed a form that she didn't understand because she wanted to get out of there. She managed to get through the mechanism. She's now in a house that she thinks should be safe. My Lord, she's already been bullied with people from different countries. She needs specialist care and has had an operation and was struggling to walk when I met her that day.
That was Baroness Newlove, the Victims Commissioner, describing the plight of a young, disabled Albanian woman as the Lords debated a call to provide better support for the victims of modern slavery, people who've been trafficked into Britain for forced labour, domestic servitude or forced prostitution. The Conservative Lord McColl had proposed a bill on the issue, saying inadequate support for known slavery victims was causing yet more damage.
Frontline support agencies have highlighted cases where confirmed victims are destitute and sleeping on the streets, refused access to welfare benefits or housing, and have then engaged in prostitution because they were not entitled to any form of support.
His bill proposed a reflection and recovery period of 45 days and a further 12 months following confirmation of their status as a victim of modern slavery. He was supported by the Bishop of Derby, the Right Reverend Alistair Redfern, who'd met victims in his home city.
Women who'd been raped 10 times a day and asked for drugs to save them from the pain. People in domestic servitude who sleep on the floor and on call 24/7 and trapped in a house. 16 or 20 men in the city of Derby, living in a two-up, two-bedroom, a two-up, two-down house, one bathroom, bus to work, bus back, £5 a week to spend, passport confiscated.
The former Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Prescott, highlighted the need for international cooperation against slavery.
We have a summit on slavery taking place in 2 weeks' time. We lead the world in that. It's important that we follow new initiatives in a cooperative way, and that can do something about the mass migration which leads to slavery.
And the Conservative former Health Secretary, Lady Bottomley, said awareness of the problem was still low.
It's rather like when we first uncovered the breadth and depth of child sexual abuse. Many of us had worked in this field for many years, in welfare organisations, in the churches, and nobody really understood how insidious and how widespread and how covert this was as a real social ill of the modern world.
Lord McColl's bill was given government support, and as is usual in the Lords, it got an unopposed second reading. It now goes forward for detailed scrutiny. Now, the Commons battle that looks set to dominate the remainder of 2017 began in earnest this week. MPs are halfway through a two-day second reading debate on the EU withdrawal bill, and the whole House of Commons will then spend at least 8 days, and quite possibly more than that, working through the fine detail of what all sides regard as a critical piece of Brexit legislation. The bill transfers 4 decades' worth of EU law into British law, but it also gives ministers sweeping powers to rewrite that law, and its critics say these so-called Henry VIII powers will sideline Parliament. The Conservative Anna Soubry highlighted the concerns at Prime Minister's Question Time on Wednesday.
There are many concerns, very serious concerns, along these benches about the means, not the ends, of the EU withdrawal bill. So could my right honourable friend assure me that she will look in particular at those amendments that seek to change the EU withdrawal bill so that it doesn't become an unprecedented and unnecessary government power grab. Yeah.
Theresa May was in conciliation mode.
I would like to reassure my right honourable friend that as the bill goes through its scrutiny in this House and the debate continues, we will, of course, listen very carefully to that debate, and I will be very happy to meet my right honourable friend to discuss this further.
Next to signal concerns was the House of Lords Authoritative Constitution Committee, which published what for them was a strongly worded report on Thursday, full of terms like breathtaking, extraordinary and unprecedented. The committee's chaired by the Labour peer Anne Taylor, a former leader of the Commons. She accepted that the government faced a huge and difficult task, but said there were still major concerns about this bill.
There are some global powers in here, and I think it's Clause 17, which actually more or less says that government ministers can make any law that Parliament would normally make. That's not just unusual, it's unprecedented, and that's why we are so concerned. We're also worried because there are lots of ambiguities in here about retained EU law and domesticated EU law, and what that could mean is that the lawyers have a field day.
Her committee's report will certainly be influential when the Lords comes to debate the bill. But in the Commons, the veteran Conservative Brexiteer Bill Cash was unimpressed.
Of course, it wouldn't be unuseful to look at the names of those who are on the Constitutional Committee and to make a judgment about their enthusiasm for our leaving the European Union.
All the same, plenty of MPs raised concerns about the bill. The Conservative and former Attorney General Dominic Grieve warned that he might not be able to vote for it.
Unless this bill is substantially improved in the course of the committee stage, I regret to have to say to my right honourable friends and honourable friends, I would be in no position to support it at third reading in its current form. It is in many respects an astonishing monstrosity of a bill.
Labour's Hilary Benn, the chair of the Brexit Select Committee, warned that the powers it gave were unacceptable.
All of us accept that there is a need to do this, and all of us therefore accept that a bill is necessary, but that does not mean that Parliament should accept this bill.
He predicted that the government, lacking a majority in the Commons, would be forced to retreat. With no outright government majority, the bill does look pretty vulnerable, especially with Labour now whipping its MPs to vote against the second reading. But pro-Brexit Labour MPs could provide a lifeline, at least on some issues. Among their number is Graham Stringer.
It's not my purpose to bail the government out. It's my purpose, for the sake of democracy, apart from anything else, is to ensure that the decision taken by the people of the United Kingdom in the referendum is carried through. It is very tempting, and I understand this temptation when you've got a weak Conservative government, to play tactical games. It might get you some reward in the short term. I think in the long term it's a mistake, particularly when 70% of Labour constituencies voted to leave.
And how many Labour MPs do you think are going to take the same line that you are?
I have no idea. I mean, there are going to be three positions of Labour MPs on this second reading of this bill. There will be those who support it because it is effectively implementing the referendum decision. There will be those that vote with the Labour whip, and there will be a number of abstentions. I have no idea how many, but some Labour MPs will certainly abstain. On particular details where the government might be taking too many powers to themselves, they can't rely on my vote for that. I will look at each amendment, each part of the bill, as it comes along, because the bill certainly, in detail, needs improving.
MPs will vote on giving the bill their initial approval on Monday, and they'll also vote on a programme motion setting out a timetable for the detailed debate that will follow. There could well be more demands for debating time. But is this an argument about proper parliamentary powers, or is it really about guerrilla resistance to Brexit? The Conservative Mark Harper was chief whip under David Cameron.
If people try to either not have the bill in the first place or to take the next 2 years talking about it, what they're actually effectively saying to the public is we either don't want to leave the European Union, which I suspect is what's behind some people who are going to vote against the bill on Monday, SNP, for example, or they want it not to go well. So I think this is different. There is a timetable here. There's an end point. And I think trying to delay this, inordinately would only be done by somebody who actually didn't want the country to get a good deal and exit the EU in a sensible way. And I don't think that would be very constructive.
MPs will start that series of votes on the bill at around midnight on Monday. This week, the Commons leapt from one row about its committee system to another. First, there were vociferous complaints and cross letters from the chairs of the various select committees. They'd been elected back in July, but their actual committees had still not been appointed. In the Commons, Defence Committee Chair Julian Lewis complained to the Speaker.
Is there anything you can do to help us? Because I know several committees have got meetings scheduled, hearings for next week, which will have to be aborted if we cannot get this simple problem resolved this week.
Speaker John Bercow's patience was clearly running short.
My simple message in a non-partisan spirit on behalf of backbenchers in all parts of the House is, for goodness sake, stop faffing around and get on with it.
And so it was that yesterday the Commons motions needed to establish the select committees were published. They should be approved on Monday. Meg Hillier, the former Labour minister who now chairs the powerful Public Accounts Committee, said the wait had been unacceptable.
Incredibly frustrating, because when you get elected as a chair, you know, full of ideas, fizzing with what you'd like to do, formally you can do none of that until you have a committee. We obviously had some committee members elected before the summer and some good idea of some, in some cases, of which members from the government party, the Conservatives, would be joining us. So I was, for instance, very much in touch with them over the summer, but formally we couldn't move on. So there was enormous frustration building up over the summer. And when we came back, we really put our case to the Chief Whip and the Leader of the House. But we were, I think, cross-party, massively frustrated that these committees of Parliament couldn't be established without the government's say-so. And that's an anomaly we've really got to resolve.
What were the explanations coming out of the government?
There is this cumbersome procedure of this committee of selection. That's held up because of the government's lack of an overall majority. There's a big discussion about the numbers on the committees that debate bills. But we felt that it was very unfair to hold up select committees for that reason, because you could get the select committees going, whatever arguments then happen about the standing committees. So very much it was very procedural. Clearly, before the summer, there were a lot of other priorities as the government would see it. We felt there could be nothing of a higher priority than getting committees up and running. Personally, I think if I were the government chief, I'd be wanting to have my backbenchers busy rather than sort of being idle and causing trouble for them. That we've now got to the right solution.
But, as Meg Hillier mentioned there, a parallel row remains over the government's wish to guarantee itself a majority on the Public Bill Committee, sometimes called standing committees, which look in detail at legislation. Ministers want a majority on those, even though they don't have a majority in the Commons itself. A minor storm's blown up about this, with Labour calling it an attempt to rig Parliament. The SNP's Pete Wishart wasn't happy either.
This government has no means to expect to have a majority on the standing committees of the House. They do not command the majority. This is a House of minorities, and that parliamentary reality and arithmetic has to be reflected into the parliamentary standing committees of this House. So my last question, does the Leader of the House understand and appreciate she is in a minority in this House, and all the committees must recognise that reality?
A House business motion on this issue will be debated on Tuesday. The Lib Dem Alistair Carmichael was Deputy Chief Whip under the Coalition.
The rules of the House normally provide that membership of committees should reflect the membership of the House as a whole. So if you have a majority in the House, then you have a majority in committees. Now, of course, Theresa May's government doesn't have a majority in the House. They're only there because of a confidence and supply arrangement with the DUP. But despite that, they're saying, forget the result of the election. That doesn't really matter. We want to have the majority. We want to have control of everything anyway. I think it is an affront to democracy. It is a constitutional outrage.
But isn't it what governments do anyway? I mean, there's certainly precedents in the mid-70s when they had a hung parliament there for the then Labour government to take control of committees. There are even sort of precedents from the John Major years.
John Major actually just withdrew the whip, but MPs continued largely to vote in support of the government. There has never been a case before where a government did not win a majority at a general election, but still insisted on proceeding in this way.
You say that, but doesn't the Commons still have the ability, if it wants to overturn anything that's done in those committees, at a later stage of consideration?
These things are possible, but that's not how the system is supposed to work. If that was the test that you would apply, then frankly, why would we bother having an election at all?
You were a government whip not all that long ago. Would you have liked a situation where every time there was a bill committee, your bills were being being filleted by opposition parties and you were having to try and cope with that. You can see why they're doing it, can't you?
I was a government whip for 3.5 years after the 2010 general election, when, you will recall, there was then a hung parliament, and as a result of that, we had a coalition. Because we had a coalition, we never found ourselves in the position where we lacked a majority in a committee, because we had a majority in the House. That's the rule from which there really is no getting away for Theresa May, and in fact, what she's wanting to do here is run a minority government, but pretend that she has a majority.
And do you think that this motion will get through? Presumably the Conservatives have the Northern Ireland DUP lined up behind them for this vote.
We shall see what happens with the DUP, because, of course, they are bound only from confidence and supply. That's to say things like Queen's speech for the programme of government and budgets. They're not bound to vote for this, and I very much hope that they won't, because at the end of the day, they could become the victims of this as easily as anybody else. It remains to be seen whether, in fact, there will be enough Conservative MPs who, if a Labour government had tried this, would have been climbing the walls. It will remain to be seen whether there will be enough of them who will have the gumption to tell their own government that this is just not on.
But this afternoon, the Prime Minister defended the plan.
We have a working majority in Parliament, and I think it's important that that working majority is covered in all the aspects of what the Parliament of work that Parliament does.
Not a paragraph, then.
No, what we are doing is ensuring that the government's working majority is available across the business in Parliament.
Theresa May. Brexit may be dominating parliamentary business at the moment, but there are other vital issues MPs want to get to grips with. Next week, we'll see the first meeting of a new all-party group on knife crime. Sarah Jones, the newly elected Labour MP for Croydon Central, raised the issue and the toll it takes on young lives in the Commons earlier this week.
15-year-old Jermaine Grupel was stabbed to death in Croydon. Jermaine was the 15th teenager to die in a knife attack in London this year. 15 young lives wasted. These devastating stories are in the news every time we switch on the TV or open a newspaper. But behind every headline is a family ruined, a local community in shock, more and more parents afraid to let their children out of their sight, and tragically, a generation of young people who are becoming increasingly anxious and, in many cases, desensitised to the existence of dangerous weapons in their communities.
Well, when I spoke to her after that debate, Sarah Jones told me she wanted a comprehensive strategy to tackle knife crime and the gang culture behind it.
We've seen a massive increase in knife crime over the last 2 years, and it's a problem that's going beyond London and around to the rest of the country as well. It's a UK-wide problem. And I promised during the general election that if I was elected, I would set up an all-party group to try and tackle and prevent these kind of horrific crimes, which have seen, for example, 15 teenagers killed in London just this year from knife crime.
What does a prevention agenda look like? What sort of measures would you like to see being put in place?
What we've seen is the impact of many years of cuts on a lot of different public services that could be intervening to stop children getting involved in crime. Obviously education, obviously youth services, but also Department of Health. We've seen mental health cuts, so we have a lot of people who are getting involved in criminal activity, who are carrying knives, who have mental illnesses as well as other issues that they need support for. So what we need to do is make sure we're funding all of those services properly, but what we also need to do is make sure we're using the right interventions at the point at which people are starting to get involved in gangs to stop them doing that. So that's a lot of youth work, a lot of intensive work with young people to show them that they have choices and they have options, and that actually there are good things out there that they can do that don't involve crime and don't involve carrying knives.
Now, your all-party group in a sense debuted on the floor of the House this week when you had your adjournment debate on knife crime. What did you hear from other MPs and from the government minister, Sarah Newton?
Well, the first thing was that there were a lot of MPs from different parties at the debate, which was great, and I wanted to get as many people from different political sides as possible to come together, because I think this needs to be something we talk about together and resolve together. I got a commitment from the minister that she would meet with us, that she would talk to us more about some of the interventions that she's looking at and some of the things that we can do. I think she welcomed the fact that I'd spent the whole summer talking to as many different organisations as possible, pulling together evidence on what works and what the issues are, but also what the solutions are that I hope to take to the Home Office and develop with her.
And what's the next step?
Well, we're meeting next week as an all-party group for the first time, and then we'll set our agenda for the year. What I'm hoping is that what I called for, which was a 10-year strategy on knife crime. If you remember, there was a 10-year strategy on cutting teenage pregnancies back under the last Labour government. It was very effective because it was a long-term strategy and it involved lots of different government agencies and departments working together. I want to see something similar. So what I would love to see is the all-party group working on each of the different topic areas to look at, for example, social media. What impact is that having on young people? We know it's huge in terms of their sense that they ought to be carrying a knife, that it's cool to carry a knife, that it's the thing that young people do. There's lots of different dimensions to this debate, and I want the all-party group to look at each of those dimensions.
Sarah Jones. Back now to today's events in the Lords. Peers have been discussing the age of criminal responsibility. The Lib Dem peer, Lord Dulacquia, introduced a bill to raise the age from 10 to 12 in England and Wales. He said the current level was out of step with most other countries, including Scotland, where the age is 12. It was also in contravention of recommendations from the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child.
In a statement in 1997, the committee said, and I quote, "State parties are encouraged to increase the lower minimum age of criminal responsibility to the age of 12 years as the absolute minimum age and to continue to increase it to a higher age level."
The crossbench or independent peer, Earl Listowel, said the current arrangement was barbarous.
"Very many of the 10 and 11-year-olds in question will either have been in local authority care or would be in care if their local authority were not so overstretched. Yet again, we are criminalising the abused, neglected children of our society."
Another crossbencher, Lady Murphy, who's a psychiatrist, said it was preposterous that children should be criminalised at 10.
"We as society have usually failed the children who come before the courts by the age of 3. But it is not too late to intervene in those of 10 or 12, and I know people are trying to do so. But in fact, we could intervene by starting to say, this is not the way to treat children of 10.
Labour supported the bill, but the minister, Lady Vere, wasn't convinced. She said safeguards were already in place.
"The government has also taken steps to make sure that these young people are not subject to custody except in the most serious cases. Custody is only available for 10 and 11-year-olds if they commit a crime where an adult would be liable to a sentence of at least 14 years imprisonment."
Lord Dulacquia's bill received its second reading and will now be considered in committee. The question of hereditary peers was also occupying the minds of members of the Lords. There are 92 such peers, and under current rules, that number has to be maintained. So if one hereditary peer dies or retires, a by-election is held for a replacement. Last year, Labour's Lord Grocott tried to end the by-election system, but his bill was defeated. Undeterred, he's back with another version. He explained that the by-elections were absurd and indefensible.
"What's the justification for the heir of a hereditary peer, let's say in this House, having a 1 in 200 chance of becoming a member of the legislature, while everyone else in the country, the chance is something like 1 in 90,000?
As is usual in the Lords, his bill received a second reading without opposition. Now, as Hurricane Irma powers on, peers expressed concern about the speed of Britain's reaction to the disaster. A Conservative, Lord Naseby, wondered why better preparations hadn't been made.
"Given that hurricanes are not new in the Caribbean, that they always happen at this time of year, why is it that there was no standby facility to deal with this sort of emergency? Particularly when we see that France and Holland had prepared and were able to react speedily, much more speedily than we've been able to do."
For the government, Earl Cortown explained that the French and Dutch had a military base close by, and there was one British vessel on the scene.
"The Royal Fleet Auxiliary Mount Bay, which was in action very quickly in Anguilla. It was not tied up against the dock because this was not actually a very safe place to be. And at the initial warnings to this event, my lords, it was not exactly clear where the hurricanes would actually hit."
Earl Cortown. And that brings us to our closing headline from Westminster. There's been strong support in the House of Lords for a bill to help the victims of modern slavery. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Mandy Baker. And that was Today in Parliament.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.